Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we are just having a rip-roaring good time here right before we get set recording tonight. So I'm looking forward to bringing in our regular crew. And of course, that always includes Sam Bradley. And Sam, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Jamie, other than we, strangely, have not seen the sun all day here in my part of Colorado, and it just started raining, which I certainly don't mind. We can always use the wetness, but of course the wind's coming with us, and that's part of the summer weather, strangely. There's all kinds of strange weather patterns I'm learning about in Colorado, and we're going to talk a little bit about those, but we got our friend Kevin from Texas on with us to give us some perspective, and of course we have Dr. Joe, and we have Kyle, our weather expert, and we're going to toss it to him because a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight has to do with summer weather issues. Kyle?
Well, thanks, Sam, and good evening, everyone. Just want to thank you for joining us here. Let's take a quick look back at the last 2 weeks here of hazardous weather since we did skip a week. On July 19, we had a pretty widespread damaging wind event that extended from South Dakota through Illinois with winds measured up to 100 miles per hour with that system. There were three tornadoes that occurred in western New York on July 20, and there were actually two EF2 tornadoes that injured two people in Maryland on July 23rd. So an active weather pattern across the northern part of the U.S. there. And that's definitely going to be the trend here moving forward. One other event of note, a quite tragic event that occurred back on July 15th. There was a large family gathering out in south central Arizona at a remote river location. And tragically, 10 people were swept away and killed in a flash flood. It was a horrifically perfect combination of factors, with heavy monsoon season thunderstorms over mountainous terrain on top of a burn scar or an area that was recently burned. And that all that runoff was funneled into a narrow, twisting canyon. And unfortunately, this is actually not the first time flash flooding has killed groups of people in canyons. In 2015, 7 people were killed in Utah's Zion National Park. And in 1997, we had 11 hikers killed in flash flooding near Page, Arizona. So always, as you're out and about, definitely want to be weather aware. That's a quick disaster weather roundup. Sam, back to you.
Wow. I actually had to step off for just a second. So I kind of missed what you were just saying.
No, it's okay. I can jump in.
Jamie, I wanted to touch base with you because you actually had some issues in that storm in Maryland, didn't you?
Yeah, well, we didn't. The tornadoes were down south of us, about an hour or so south of where I am. But that same weather system came through over the course of 2 days, just heavy, heavy rain downpours, flash flooding warnings in our region. And of course, yesterday we lost power for about 6 hours when a tree on just up the road from us came down across some power lines as some heavy winds blew the tree over. So, you know, it's a pretty big, you know, we saw these storms coming across the country and heard about some things. And actually, I had some things I wanted to bring up with Kyle because I learned a new term about some types of downdrafts that cause issues that were related to, I guess, extremely strong straight line winds. Is that correct, Kyle?
Yes, absolutely, Jamie. I think the term that you're referring to is microburst. And is that kind of what you're thinking of?
It is what I'm thinking of. You know, it seems like, you know, that they really, I've heard that this extreme rain coming down, the cold rain actually drives the winds down straight from the clouds. And then that spreads out across the surface of the ground in these straight line winds that can reach up to 150 miles an hour, which is pretty strong.
Absolutely. The straight line winds actually, they're very common in the decaying stage of a thunderstorm. So as that updraft begins to weaken and finally dies out, there's no warm, moist air to fuel the storm and hold all that precipitation up in the cloud. So as that precipitation falls out, it evaporates And because evaporation is a cooling process, it further cools the air, makes it more dense, and it rushes towards the ground, hits the ground, and spreads out in all directions from the center. So think about dropping a large balloon full of water into a field of grass, and it kind of spreads out and lays out from the center. And as you hinted at, Jamie, definitely the potential for some very intense straight-line wind damage over a fairly large area sometimes. And these occur, you know, we can predict them over very short time periods, but it's really hard to tell as meteorologists where and when exactly they're going to occur. So yet another hazard that thunderstorms present.
Yeah, I've experienced a couple of those in Colorado, but it didn't seem like a particularly unique weather day. I don't even recall that it was raining, but I actually was away from the house for a while. I came back and my very heavy umbrella with very heavy bases on it were flung across the yard and into the fence, and it's like, what happened here? So that's kind of a new one for me. But a related term, Kyle, maybe you can explain the difference, is downdrafts. How does that work? Is it, it's another wind anomaly, correct?
Yeah, definitely. So the downdrafts, microbursts, it, you know, just different names for very similar features. So it's the rain cooled air that's falling down out of a cloud or out of a thunderstorm. So that's what we're referring to with downdrafts. So that cool air that you'll sometimes feel, that you know that it kind of hits you and you can smell rain, but before the storm even hits, that's the downdraft, that rain cooled air rushing out ahead of that storm, letting you know that something's coming.
Wow. So Jamie, you have a backup generator, right?
I just have battery backup for my computer equipment and stuff like that. So, yeah. You know, I was able to finish working on something I was working on before I had to power down and stuff. But
yeah, I can see you losing your mind 6 hours without any computer.
Well, it was nighttime, so I just finished what I was doing and got the kids squared away and then went to bed. So,
oh, okay. But anyway,
we keep glow sticks around and stuff like that for safe lighting sources, and just kind of put a couple glow sticks around the house and everybody's happy.
Yeah, I have little flashlights all over the place too. So, Joe, were you saying that you've had some floods down there in Memphis, or has it just been hot?
No, very dry here. Heat index is about 110 every day, and, you know, just sort of that sweltering southeastern summer heat for us.
I hear
you. Wow. Kevin, what about Texas? Maybe it was you that mentioned
it
that.
It was heat index of averaging about 110. This week it's going to be on the dial. It's going to be 100 plus.
Oh, I'm so glad I'm not there. So is there a considerable difference between, let's just say, Memphis and Texas, Tennessee and Texas, in terms of humidity? Is Tennessee much more humid? Because that's what really kills me when I'm in the South. It's not the heat so much, but the humidity. Kyle, you want to throw that one out?
Sure, Sam, I'd love to. So with kind of humidity and things, it's humidity is actually one of my least favorite weather terms to describe kind of how it feels outside. What we're really looking at, say, from the weather side, not to say that relative humidity is a bad thing, but I want to think about it in terms of dew point. That is the temperature to which you would have to cool the air in order for dew to form. So dew points, in the central and even central part of the U.S., even up into the Midwest, once you get about to like a 50 or so degree dew point, you can definitely start to feel that moisture in the air. And why I want folks to kind of take a step back from using relative humidity is that if I'm, it can be, 80 degrees at night, say in the South perhaps, and there's an 80 degree dew point as well. So when temperature equals dew point, humidity is 100%. The same way that here in the mountains, I can have a temperature of 80 degrees, dew point might be only 20 degrees. So that's only 25% relative humidity. So it's a little bit misleading. So it's those dew points that you're looking at, and when they start creeping up 50 or above, it's absolutely unbearable. And especially me living in the mountains now, if I go back to the Midwest to visit family, I'm just like, oh, what is all this atmosphere down here?
Just don't go to the south. So, Joe, as an ER doc especially, do you see humidity-specific issues?
I don't know that we necessarily see humidity-specific issues. Obviously, the body's ability to cool by sweating and evaporation is impacted by higher humidities. And, you know, you become much less efficient at being able to sweat and then have that sweat evaporate on your skin and cool you. So, you know, heat illness is certainly not an uncommon thing in the southeastern, southwestern United States. But, you know, I think for us it tends to be issues the temperatures can be lower, but the higher humidity it makes it a little bit more likely that you could get heat illness at maybe a lower overall temperature than you might experience, say, in the Southwest.
Well, and it's also true that the younger someone is or the older someone is, they either haven't yet developed their ability to manage heat versus the older folks who maybe have lost some of their ability to manage heat. Would that be a true statement?
Well, I think certainly there's an awareness related to that and knowing your own body when you're, you know, beginning to be symptomatic and appreciating what it is that you're feeling and recognizing that that's related to, you know, potentially your core temperature going up. You know, I think young folks tend to have a more rapid adaptation period to air levels of high heat, and because they can, they tend to be in, you know, better shape. They start sweating more easily, and then they can evaporate that sweat more quickly than the very young or the very old, who often have impaired ability to sweat, maybe on medications that restrict their ability to sweat, or don't have the mobility, for example, to be able to move to a cooler environment or, you know, remove clothing that's blocking the ability of the sweat to evaporate and that sort of stuff.
Oh, good point. While we're on that topic, can you give us a, because not everybody in our audience is a medical person, can you give us a quick run through on heat illness versus heat exhaustion versus heat stroke?
Sure. And, you know, I think the easiest way to think of those things is just kind of a continuum that moves from the body's ability to respond to heat and to dissipate the excess heat that ultimately results in an elevation in your core temperature. So, you know, early on in heat illness, and I use that term here very generically, you know, you tend to have a fast heart rate as you try to push more blood through the skin, more profuse sweating as you try to get rid of, you know, more, you try to evaporate more so you can cool more. And that ultimately progresses to a point where it begins to affect your brain. It just simply doesn't work right anymore. But you also, at some point, sort of cross the threshold of the amount of sweat actually decreases as the body begins to have trouble neurologically handling things. And, of course, as that starts happening, your core temperature begins to climb very quickly. And it's when you get to these, you know, extremes of core temperature greater than, you know, 107, 108 degrees that you have significant neurologic dysfunction you know, brain injury, et cetera, ultimately death if you're not cooled down fairly quickly. So I think the way to think of these things is they're kind of a different level of severity and the body's ability to respond to that heat stress from fairly normal functioning to complete dysfunction at many levels.
Wow. The Weather Channel, I get their little emails, and they put up a scorching car scale the other day specific to the weather that day. And as an example, If the forecast is 107, as they suggested it was in Las Vegas that day, after 10 minutes, your car is 126. After 30 minutes, it's 141. And, you know, people don't think about that all the time when we leave kids and animals in the car for just a few minutes, that in 10 minutes that could, you know, create either a huge problem, perhaps death, as it has for a lot of kids. And Jamie, I'm going to throw this to you because you just threw something in the chat box about 8 people found dead in a trailer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was recently in Texas. Actually, 8 people were found dead. 30 other people were transported to area hospitals in San Antonio, Texas, in that region. And they were found in a Walmart parking lot, part of a human trafficking ring, illegal immigrants transported into the country and left in the back of a trailer. They had two people subsequently have died, so the total is now 10 dead from this incident. But when first responders got there, 8 people were already dead in the trailer. 30 others were in various levels of, as Joe just explained, this continuum of heat illness. They estimated the temperatures in the back of this trailer had reached 150 degrees. So severe injury. They're still talking about severe brain and neurological injuries to a lot of the people that were taken to hospitals that may have permanent brain damage as a result of the extreme heat that they experienced.
Oh, at least. So, Joe, what is the maximum body temperature that someone can have before brain damage starts occurring?
Well, I don't know that there's a specific temperature. You certainly start seeing concerns with that, above temperatures of 105, 106. I think the highest temperature I recall seeing in an emergency department was 107 in one of these folks. So, and that person had pretty profound neurological injury from that.
Yeah, no doubt. So, Kyle, you just threw something up, interesting statistic. You want to talk about that?
Definitely. But first, before I talk about that, I'd like to pose a question not only to all of us here on the call, but all of you that are listening out there in podcast land, online, or wherever you find yourself. Based on what Joe talked about and some of the topics we've touched on with these different heat illnesses and heat emergencies, just think, in your life, have you personally experienced a heat emergency? So just think about that. And if your mind doesn't immediately say, yes, I have, that is why heat is so dangerous. Because a lot of the focus is always on these cold emergencies, hypothermia, the lack of heat, as opposed to hyperthermia, having too much heat. And that's why over the last 30 years that the National Weather Service has been keeping natural hazard fatality statistics, the number one killer on the 30-year average, we've bypassed flooding, and heat is the number one killer on the 30-year average. So on average, 131 heat-related fatalities per year over the last 30 years. So definitely something that, not that we need to discount flooding and these other natural hazards, but perhaps those of you that are involved with, planning a response, wanting to shift perhaps some of your planning focus and your education focus towards preventing these heat emergencies.
Well, I can speak from experience. I had heat stroke back in 1986 in July, and it was no fun.
Yeah, and I think we can probably all come up with some scenarios where at least it was close. So, Kevin, since you're there, can you give us some quick bullet points, since you're our wilderness expert, on when people are backpacking, which they tend to do this time of year? We have both heat and cold issues, but what are some key things related to heat? And I want to get into some of the dangers in a minute, but what are some of the things that you would advise people to wear, to take with them, to be aware of?
Well, the number one thing is to bring plenty of water and drink it. The other thing is to be aware, both between yourself and whoever you're with, keep an eye on them. If they look like they're really flushed, call a break, stop, get in the shade, relax, take a break. Drink to thirst, meaning when you're thirsty, drink. Don't try and force, the old adage of you need to drink at least one quart of water an hour. Drink when you're thirsty. If you're not really thirsty, don't force it. I'll let Joe get into hyponatremia. But keep an eye on people. Dress for the environment. The old adage of cotton is evil. Cotton can actually help because it retains water. So when you sweat, it actually helps to cool you off because it does retain water. And if you have any kind of breeze, that will help to cool you off.
Excellent. Good advice, Kevin, and glad to hear that about cotton. That's good. Breathable clothing is probably a good thing, but
wool socks. But if it's in the summertime and you know you're going to be, you know, doing stuff during the day, wear cotton. Don't be afraid to wear a cotton shirt. But keep in mind, you'll want to change that when you stop for dinner or after you've made camp, because now you'll be sitting and you won't be sweating as much, and you don't want that to affect you negatively by causing potentially hypothermia.
Besides, you know, if you've worn that shirt all day, you'll probably smell bad. So, you know, just saying.
Not me.
So, Kyle and Kevin, I want you and the other guys to throw in on this, too, because we've probably all had different sets of experiences or understanding on this. What about lightning injuries? How common is that, Kyle?
Well, lightning injuries, there are fatalities that occur from lightning every year. And it's not just in the mountains, and it's not just, you know, in Florida, which is the lightning capital here of the U.S. And so on average, you know, long-term average, say 30 years, for the past 30 years, on average, 47 people a year die from lightning-related injuries. And while they are not terribly common, when you're looking compared to other weather hazards, you really want to, again, just be aware if you're hiking in an environment and there are thunderstorms in the forecast or you see the clouds start to build, you definitely want to take steps to reduce your exposure to those lightning risks. Here in the mountains, if you're hiking, say, you know, above tree line, or you're in an open or exposed area, even just a few hundred feet descending in elevation can reduce your risk significantly. And also, you know, if you're in a group and there's, you know, lightning that begins to occur, if you can't seek shelter in either a sturdy structure or a, you know, hard top vehicle or something of that nature, if you're out, you want to spread yourself out and reduce your contact with the ground so that you can reduce the likelihood that if a lightning strike was to occur within the vicinity, that everyone in the group would be affected.
Kevin, I mean, he's talking about one option. If you're out there with no shelter to speak of, any other recommendations you would have?
You want to stay low, stay out of trees, like Kyle said. Avoid anything metal. The other thing is, if you can hear thunder, you're close enough to be struck by lightning.
Good point.
And they've had cases where, you know, lightning was noticed miles away, but they were close enough to hear it. And one of the bigger stories was it was two people. They were standing really close together. It struck one of them, and the other person got injured by the splash. But another thing, if you're going to stay on the ground, keep, like Kyle said, keep your point of impact on the ground as minimal as possible. So crouch down, get in the fetal position on your feet, if that makes any sense. Crouch down, don't lay on the ground. Keep your feet on the ground and kind of roll into the fetal position while maintaining your vertical position. So that way only your feet are in contact with the ground, and hopefully you'll have rubber soles or something that doesn't conduct electricity. That's what the advised position is.
And if you're on the golf course, leave. You know, I have to tell you guys a true story. We had a DMAT thing going on, a summit going on in Orlando one year. And there's a boardwalk there that has a metal railing. And I did not go with this group that day. But one of my friends who's an EMT is like 6'9", I mean, he's quite tall. So he's walking with, I don't know, three or four other people. And it was one of those typical Florida afternoon thunderstormy kind of days. And lightning hit the rail, bounced off the rail, and went through his foot. And, of course, when everybody gets back, they're saying, oh, by the way, he got hit by lightning. I'm going, what? You're kidding me. You know, and it's fortunate, and I'm guessing I'm correct about this, but if it hadn't been attracted by the rail, it might have been attracted by Bruce's height and gone completely through him. But he did have a significant burn on his foot, and he was pretty goofy for the whole rest of that trip. So we've called him Sparky ever since. But, I mean, that was probably a closer call than we care to admit. Joe, you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it certainly sounds like he was, close enough to at least have some of that electrical current pass through him and cause that burn. Obviously lightning is going to spread through anything that will conduct it and tends to take the course of least resistance, of course. So, he may have just been far enough away from the primary strike point that he still absorbed some through the ground or whatever conductor he was in contact with that ultimately resulted in a burn.
Well, he claims he could smell it, and that the lightning itself went down in front of him, that he could even describe what it looked like. I mean, it was that close to him. So that was really freaky. I think he was extremely lucky that rail was there, and it kind of deflected it away from him. But everybody there could kind of feel, however you want, a little tingly from it, and they all ran. They ran into the closest building. I mean, it did have an effect, like something that Kyle was saying, on everybody in that group, and I imagine other people as well. Jamie, any thoughts on that?
It's one of those things that it's like the entry point of a bullet wound. You never know where the electricity goes after it enters the body. So you have to have that. I've always been taught to have that index of suspicion regarding, where the electricity passed, so that you might have internal burns or other neurological injuries related to the electricity passing through the body.
Wow. Man, this is scary stuff. I'm glad when the fall comes, I'm sure we'll have other issues. So we're got to wrap it up here pretty quick, but we're going to wrap it up. Kyle, you had a thought on treating lightning victims. I actually, in this case I was discussing, I called we both work for the same ambulance company. I called our medical director and I go, what do we do about this? How dangerous is it? Do we need to take him to the ER? What's going on? Because it wasn't something that any of us were terribly familiar with. So what are your thoughts on treating lightning injuries? And then we'll run that by Joe.
Well, yeah, I'm definitely interested to hear from the rest of the group. But I think one of the biggest kind of misnomers or myths out there is that anyone who's struck by lightning, any human struck by lightning, holds a charge. And that's absolutely not true. So once that lightning strike occurs, that charge dissipates, and you should immediately begin treatment of that person. It's a large electrical charge, a surge that goes through the body. And so it'll more than likely disrupt those typical heart rhythms and things. And so you want to immediately begin a rapid assessment of that person and assess if they're conscious, are they breathing, and if they have a pulse. And if not, you can immediately jump in and begin CPR if that's necessary. So that's my take on it. Just wanted to throw that piece out there.
Yeah, Kevin just sent us a picture of a bunch of dead cows with the comment that ground current actually hit every one of them. So, Joe, unless someone has a direct damage to the heart, a fairly young person with a healthy heart can be brought back pretty quickly if someone started CPR right away, if this was just a disruption of their regular rhythms?
Well, the answer to that is maybe. First of all, thanks, Kyle, for pointing out that, people aren't still electrically charged after that. And, yes, immediately take care of them. but depending on sort of the level of the injury, and by that I mean sort of how much electrical charge passed through them, it can range from something as simple as we were just talking about to the potential for disruption of the nervous system, the electrical impulses of the nervous system, which of course can cause cardiac arrhythmias, seizures,
and that sort of stuff. But, you know, when significant amounts of current pass through the body, it basically, much like touching a high voltage wire, essentially results in a severe burn along the, you know, the path of the electricity. So those folks could easily have, you know, massive burns, rupture of vessels and, you know, hollow organs and that sort of stuff. Even musculoskeletal injuries from the tetanic contractions of all the muscles, which can do things like we see sometimes in people who have seizures, where they can have compression fractures in their back and that sort of stuff from all of their muscles suddenly contracting with intense force and ultimately resulting in some damage to the supporting framework of our body.
Wow. Kevin has been sending us some very unique pictures of lightning burns that look like very unique tattoos. So, Jamie, I think every one of us probably learned something new in this discussion, and hopefully those in our audience did too. If nothing else, stay away from lightning. get into a safe place.
Well, I mean, it's like what Kyle's been talking about since we've had him on the show. You know, weather awareness. You know, be conscious of what's around you, what's potentially coming in your direction, and be aware that even weather at a little bit of a distance, such as severe storms in a nearby mountain range, can cause flash flooding that could affect the area you're in. So all these things, I think, are some of the lessons we've learned from this episode.
I actually am, and I think we mentioned this before, that in every area there are, and Kyle could give you a lot of references, but in every area there are, and I can't remember which one I'm actually plugged into, but one of the weather sites will tell me when lightning has been detected within 5 miles of my home, when significant rain is coming down within 5 miles of my home. And those are kind of good because, like Kevin said, if you hear thunder, you can actually be in danger and not even realize it. So those kind of alerts are a good thing to have. So you should probably check your local area so that they and set yourself up with those kinds of notices. And that way you're a little bit more in the know.
And a quick note about that, they actually sell devices that claim to be able to detect lightning in the area. They're not that reliable. So if you happen to have one, don't rely strictly on that device because they have been proven not to work all the time and not give an effective warning, or they'll give a false warning. So just keep that in mind if you happen to have one of those devices. They're not expensive, but they're not cheap. But if you have them, just keep that in mind.
Well, I'll leave it to the experts.
And, if I can chime in a quick word on that. It's one of the biggest drawbacks with those personal lightning detectors is, so with any type of data or measurement, they classify it into bins. So it's like a range bin, let's say, of these strikes were 1 to 5 miles away. These strikes were 5 to 15 miles away, and these were 15 plus. Well, 5 to 15 miles, you know, that's a big range, and I would have different, say, action steps at a 15-mile away lightning strike versus a 5-mile away lightning strike. So the accuracy definitely isn't there, and, you know, for personal kind of awareness, it's a good tool at purely an awareness stage. But if it's life safety and you're monitoring, say, for a professional event, either, you know, find a private service that does that or purchase a professional lightning detection system if you're tasked with protecting a fixed site like a stadium or something of that nature. And before you use any of the monitoring tools, know how to read and interpret the data to make those decisions effectively.
Yeah, good point. So, and follow your gut. If your gut's telling you shouldn't be there, you probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
And listen to shows like this that give us good education, right, Jamie?
Yeah, definitely. And like what Kyle just said, train yourself to use the equipment you have appropriately, and it all comes back around to training, like it always does. You know, that's why we do the show. We try to give a little bit of training here on the back end, and of course we're associated with Paragon Medical Education Group, who are just a premier training organization out there. And Joe, you know, I I know you guys don't do specifically weather-related stuff all the time, but, you know, I'm sure it comes into factoring into how you approach things in a given disaster situation.
Well, it does, and, you know, certainly we a big part of what we do is weather-related disaster scenarios, whether that's an earthquake or a hurricane or whichever. So those are definitely a part of our core experiences.
If folks want to bring Paragon into their system and reach out to you guys and find out how they can bring you in to do some specific disaster-related training for them, where can they reach you?
Well, they can find us on the web at ParagonMedicalEducationGroup.com. We're also have a Facebook page, Paragon Medical Group, as well. They can contact us through the Disaster Podcast as well.
Excellent. And I think, Kevin, you and Kyle and Sam have teamed up for a unique kind of, I guess, a prototype training event coming up soon. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
So October 7th and 8th, pending the final venue, but that's pretty much the weekend it's going to be, we're going to be getting together in the Denver area, and we're going to be having a weekend course. We're going to be doing some wilderness first aid, and our very own Kyle has volunteered to come and do some weather courses. We're going to have Brian Duff from the Mind for Survival podcast teaching some good stuff, and we're also going to have Sam come out and give us a few lectures and demos on some of her stuff. So it looks to be like it's going to be a really exciting weekend. Plan on getting almost no sleep because there's going to be a lot going on and good times, and we'll have lots of pictures and videos to share when it's all done.
And I think that's a few weeks before EMS World Expo too, so we'll there'll be a lot of stuff going on in that neck of the woods between Colorado and Nevada and everything else out west. So exciting.
He's going to wear me out before Expo, Jamie. That'll be fun.
You have no idea, Sam.
We'll Excellent. See. Hey, Kevin, where can folks find you if they want to check out what you're doing on the web?
They can find me at wildsafety.com, and I have links to all my social media links, my email and phone number, and all that good stuff is there. You can also find me over at the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. And as always, I check the website for comments.
Excellent. And thanks for coming on tonight.
Thanks for having me, Jimmy.
Yeah. Kyle, where can people find you?
Well, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to connect with me there and continue the conversation online.
And Sam, how about you?
Ditto on that. Find me in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 on the Facebook site and disasterpodcast.com. Please come and give us your comments and your thoughts and tell us what you want us to talk about. And what about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media settings, and of course, always over hanging out in the Facebook land on our Disaster Podcast group. So please head over there. I always, when we have a new episode come up on disasterpodcast.com, I always cross-post it over into that group as well. And then if you have a question or something and you don't post it on the main site, you can always post it in the Facebook group, and we'll see if we can't get back to you with an answer in a timely fashion. But it's always good to have folks on and checking out what we're doing, and the group continues to grow, so that's kind of exciting.
Yes, we do have a good group of regulars these days, and we enjoy them a lot because they all have a different level of expertise.
Definitely. But, you know, Sam, I think about all the things we learned about the weather-related, the heat injuries, the flooding, the lightning strikes, all of the things that, you know, they're all thankfully often few and far between, but still occur frequently enough that we need to be aware about them.
Absolutely. And as we say, disaster medicine, as well as weather medicine, is not our everyday medicine.